Okay, we're here today with Marcia Smoke, a member of the 1968 U.S. Olympic team. The interviewer is Trinity Gibbons, one of the members of the 1968 Memorialization Project. And we're going to go ahead and get started with some questions. Okay, Marcia, I first just kind of want to get to know a little bit about how you grew up, where you grew up, and how you got into your sport, and just a little bit of background, biographical questions to get to know you a little bit better. So why don't we start out with just where you grew up and how you got into kayaking.
Okay, I was born and raised in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and I was born in 1941, July 18th, 1941. And I had an older sister, 2 years older than myself. Her name was Sperry. And we kind of grew up out in the country, and we're tomboys. And when we were about 10, we learned to swim. And at that time, my father was working in Venezuela as an engineer. And we would go down there in the summers to visit him. And we joined the local country club for something to do, and they had a swim coach. And he got us into competitive swimming down there in Venezuela. So we spent 4 summers there when I was 10, 11, 12, and 13, I think. And when we came back to the States, after a couple of years of swimming down there, my mother saw that we really enjoyed the swimming competition, and she started the Oklahoma City Swim Team, and of which we were members. And we swam in age group competition all over the United States during our early teen years. And I desperately wanted to go to the Olympics. I just had Olympic fever. I loved the Olympics. And I thought I could go in swimming, and I tried out in 1956, and I did 103. I was good, but not good enough to make the team. And 1960 rolled along, and my mother said, "Well, you girls aren't going to make the team in swimming, so I'll take you to the Rome Olympics, and you can watch, at least do that." So we went to Rome in 1960, my mother and my sister and I, and we watched the Rome Olympics, and we saw a sport called canoeing. We didn't know anything about it, but it was another event, so we went to that, and I saw women, under canoeing, there's canoe and kayaking, and only the men do canoeing. They do canoe and kayak, and the women do just kayak. But I saw the American women do poorly, and I thought to myself, well, maybe there's a sport, you know, I can get into and excel at.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came back to the States, I was going to the University of Michigan at the time. My sister and I were, and my mother called up a fellow. We heard about a fellow in Niles, Michigan, which is right north of South Bend, Indiana, who sold Olympic racing kayaks made in Denmark. So we remembered that, and we called him up in Niles in the fall of 60. And my mother said, "I have 2 daughters here that want to go to the next Olympics." Kind of, you know, bold-like. But sure, come on down.
Yeah.
So we went down to Niles, and he put us in a kayak, and a four-man kayak, and I was hooked after that. And took up a sport, bought my first boat the next spring. I was 61 and practiced on the Huron River there in the Ann Arbor. And by 1964, I made my first Olympic team to Tokyo, where I won a bronze medal in the single. My sister was she was fourth in the trials, so she didn't make that team, but then she made the Mexico City team.
Can you talk a little bit more about the specifics of your training leading up to making those teams? Did you work primarily by yourself with your sister, or how did you sort of go about training for those Olympic Games?
Well, I was still swimming I swam in college for a club team and Ann Arbor swim team, and then in the fall of 62, I transferred to Michigan State. And swam up there on their team, and I was kayaking in Michigan State. I was kayaking by myself on a Lake Lansing, and I remember in the winter of 63, 64, I trained, I did a lot of weight training. There was a fella in the weight room that kind of took me under his wing and trained me in weight training, which I think really helped in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And for kayaking, I was on my own to train. But I used a lot of my swimming background doing intervals and stuff like that and just put it into the kayak workout. And that seemed to, you know, do the trick. And then in the summer, well, when my first national was in, summer of 1963, and so at that point I knew I probably had a chance to make the team. And the next summer of 64, I graduated from Michigan State in the winter quarter of March of 64. I think it was March, yeah. In about June, I went to California to Newport Beach. My sister and I did to train there because there was a coach there, a German coach. We didn't really have any coaches in this country, you know, American coaches.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Kayaking is a very small sport back then. And we went to California and trained with a group out there, the California Kayak Club, and we trained twice a day. In the morning, we were on our own, and in the evening, we trained with a group that morning, in the mornings, and in the evenings, the coach came out after work to work with us. And at that, after 3 months of that, I dropped my time about 20 seconds in the 500, because all I did was chase the fellas around in the K1s, you know, lower ones, and I had my eye on them. I eventually caught a couple of them, and that really helped me drop my time. But up until the Olympics, I've never been in any international competition, so to speak. I've been to Canada a couple of times, because we had meets back and forth with Canada. But never been to Europe, where all the good kayakers were from.
Right. So were there any other women that you trained with, or was it just you and your sister and a group of men?
Mainly my sister and I and a group of men. There was another gal training out there, but she didn't train with us.
Okay. If you'd like, let's talk a little bit about the Olympic trials and making the team in 64 and what that experience was like.
The trials were held, the Tokyo Olympics were in October, from October 10th to the, or 12th to the 23rd or 4th or something like that. And our events, the kayaking was always held the second week. And we had our trials at the World's Fair in New York City on Orchard Beach Lagoon. And it was a series of 2 out of 3 races. You had to win 2 out of 3.
Mm-hmm.
We had singles, and I'm sure we had doubles races too. Back then, the women only paddled singles and doubles, whereas the men paddled singles, doubles, and fours. And that's different now, but that's before Title IX. But anyway, we went back to the trials in early September, as I remember, and I won all 3 of my singles races. And I think my sister and I came in second all 3 times to Gloria Ann and Francine from Washington, D.C., and they eventually won the silver medal in Tokyo in the doubles. So it was a big thrill for me. I made the team. You know, that was my goal right then, was to make an Olympic team, and I did. I mean, little did I know what was to come later on, you know, when I won my bronze medal.
Right.
But just to make the team, you know, that was just always something for me.
Right. Well, our particular project is about the 68 games, but I also think it's important for us to discuss your experience a little bit in 64 and certainly how that compares to 68, but just to sort of keep the timeline moving through your athletic career. If you want, let's talk a little bit about what it was like in Tokyo, and then we can go ahead and move on to comparing that to Mexico City.
Okay, I'll just be brief with Tokyo.
Okay.
Tokyo, we flew to Tokyo. So I remember there were 4 flights to Tokyo. We were on the 3rd one. 1 left each night from L.A., and we were on the 3rd one, as I recall. And we landed at the airport in Tokyo, and we were on, these were charter flights. So just the Olympic team was on the plane. And I think we went with track and field, I'm not sure. But it was just a lot of fun and pretty exciting to me with all those other Olympic athletes. But we only stayed at the village, the main village, for about a night, and then all the kayakers and canoers from all over the world stayed at Lake Sagami, which is about 30 miles from Tokyo, and that's where we had our races, and it wasn't in downtown Tokyo. So we lived out the race course. The girls lived in a youth hostel, and the man lived in a little village they had made up. And so we ate with all the Olympians from all over the world, and we slept, you know, the women slept in a dorm, and next door to you may have been the Germans or the the English or whatever, you know.
Right.
So that was pretty neat. You got to meet them and talk to them, or if you could speak their language or whatever. And we had our coach wasn't really a coach. He was given the trip for like a thank you trip, you know.
Okay.
We didn't want to rent a motorboat for $5 an hour to go out with us to coach us. So there was an Italian coach. Now, we were there for about 4 weeks before we raced, which they don't do now. So we were there quite early. And there was an Italian coach there. He was a Hungarian that had defected to Italy earlier, you know, years earlier. And he saw us there, and he saw that all three of us, the girls double, and me, we had potential. And we also wanted to come to this country. So he offered to take us under his wing, and which he did, and I'm thankful that he did that, because he probably put the finishing touches on all three of us. And we would work out with him and his team every day. And he told us there were rumblings up in the... They had a judge's tower there, and this is a very small lake. So if you went up in the judge's tower up to the top floor, like the third floor, you could see the whole lake, and you could see what everybody was doing. You could time them if they went down the race course and all that sort of thing. And so they saw, these other coaches could see us working out. And there were some rumblings around about how the Americans were doing pretty well. And so sure enough, we did. I got second in my heat for the... when we started racing it, that was on October 20th. I got second in my heat with a K1, which put me directly into the final. And so we didn't race in the next day. And the third day I raced in the final, and I got third. I got a bronze medal, and I remember that race very distinctly. Yeah, I was scared to death at the start, and we started racing. It's only a little over 2 minute race.
Okay.
And I was in lane two, and there was a Danish girl on my left, and I could hear her breathing behind me as we came down the course. And I don't want her to get any closer, you know.
Wow.
We got about 75 meters from the end, and I looked over to my right, and the Russian girl was out in front, and then there was the Romanian girl next to her, and then the rest of us were kind of all in the line. And I've never, ever had a finish. I always was the type that like to get out in front and stay there.
Right.
You know, hang out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this time I said, look, you've got 30 seconds to go, you know. Just try. And I did, and I ended up with a bronze. If the race had been 50 meters shorter, I probably would have gotten fourth. And if it had been 50 meters longer, I would have gotten second. So I ended up in a good spot.
Well, that's incredible. Thank you for sharing that story. So you finished the race. You realized you won. What type of emotions were you experiencing at that point?
Well, in the K2, the girls in the K2, one of them was Gloria Ann Perrier, and she was 35 years old. I was 23 now at the time, and she was 35. She'd been to the Roman Olympics, and she's one of the ones I saw that I thought, oh, gee, you know, she didn't do so well in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I can do better. Well, anyway, she redeemed herself at Tokyo and got herself a partner, a young girl, 15 years old, Francine. And so they were in the K2, and their race was an hour after mine. So I broke the ice winning a medal.
Right.
At least I feel I did. But anyway, as I crossed the finish line, I looked over, and there was Gloria Ann, and she had a kind of a loud voice, and she yelled out, You got third, you know. I looked over, and she was saying, I got third. She was jumping up and down and everything. So that was the first clue I had what I'd done, you know.
Right.
So I didn't know if it was really true or not, but it turned out to be true. So then an hour later, they had their race, and they got a silver medal. But I like to think that I was the first one. We're all very competitive, you know.
Oh, of course. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
It probably takes that attitude to play in an Olympic game.
You have to think that way or you'll forget it, you know.
Right. Okay, so after you were done with your competitions, do you want to talk a little bit about what else you did in Tokyo? And then we can go ahead and move on to...
I got married in 65, but my soon-to-be husband was also on the team at that time. We're divorced now, but back then, we weren't married yet, but he was on the team. He was in the K4. And they didn't make the final or anything, but after our races, we all went. My mother was there, and his parents were there. You know, my sister was there also watching. We all went. Our races were at the end of the game, so we had another day to go, and then we had the closing ceremonies, and then we left. So we went, took the bullet train down to, I think it's Kyoto, I'm not sure, wherever it went, and visited. Then we went to Hong Kong and stayed there a few days. And then we came home on, my sister and my mother and I came home on a ship to San Francisco. And while we were coming home, it took about 4 or 5 days, and while we were coming home, we got noticed that I was invited to a, they had medal winners were invited to a luncheon at the White House with LBJ, Lyndon Johnson. So that was kind of exciting. As soon as I got home, I flew right to Washington, D.C., where, of course, my teammates in the double were there also. Well, they lived there, actually, in Washington, D.C. So that was real exciting. We got to go eat lunch at the White House. But the president wasn't there. He had some important thing to do, and so Lady Bird Johnson was there. And that was a lot of fun.
That sounds incredible.
I mean, that's one little perk for winning a medal.
Yes, yeah. after the 64 games, like you said, you got home. What did you do then to prepare for the 68 games in those 4 years? Can you take us through some training that you did?
I wanted to go on. I didn't want to quit. I wanted to try and make the next team because it was so exciting. And I just loved the Olympics. And I got married in 65. And my husband then was from Detroit. And I moved from Oklahoma up to, he went to school. And we moved to Big Rapids, Michigan, where he went to school for a couple of years. And then the Muskegon River was there. And I trained by myself on the Muskegon River and doing lots of interval work and things like that. And then in the springtime, in the wintertime, I didn't train on the river. But in the springtime, I would go down to my sister lived in Florida. She'd gotten married, too, and lived in Florida. And she was still paddling, and so I would go down to her place for a while in the spring to get started on the water training. And that went on year after year. And then 68 comes along, and we had the trials in Long Beach, as I recall, Long Beach, California. And I remember during that time, one little side story, when we got to the trials, I'd won all my K-1 national championships up to that point also. So I was the best one in the country at that time. And when we got to the trials, we were there for a week or so before we raced, and we had these big daisies on our boats, our kayaks. We pasted them on. We thought they were pretty neat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of a hippie area back then. Every time. We weren't hippies, but I like the flowers. But anyway, the rowers were there also, and a lot of the rowers had long hair for the same reason, the hippie reason, I guess. But anyway, one day we came to the boathouse, and we all were in the same boathouse, the rowers and the kayakers. We came to the boathouse one time, and there was a very, very prominent sign up on the bulletin board saying the rowers need to cut their hair and the daisies need to come off the kayak, or you won't be allowed to race in the trial. And so we were very dejected and took the daisies off our boat. And I guess the rowers cut their hair. But anyway, I won all my three races. We had two out of three races you had to win. And I won those, and my sister and I won the doubles. So we went to Mexico City as the doubles team also. I paddled singles and doubles in Mexico City. And I'm really glad I got to paddle, that we paddled together. It was a good experience.
Do you want to expand on the type of relationship you had with your sister at that time, especially being her teammate?
She passed away in 2005. She had cancer. But even up to the time she passed away, she was very, very competitive. And we were both competitive, extremely competitive. I could beat her. She could beat me in everything, just about, except for kayaking. She couldn't beat me in kayaking. I think I was stronger. She weighed about 30 pounds less than me. She was real slender, and I was stronger than she was. So I could just out-muscle her at the end, you know. Most of the time, except she did tie me one time at nationals. I won 11 straight national championships in the singles. And one year, she tied me at nationals. And, of course, she never let me forget that one. But we were just extremely competitive. And, so being a teammate, if I had to pick any teammate that I knew was not going to fall down on the job, it would have been her, because she was... She never let you down. You know, she's always there.
Yeah. I think that's a really special accomplishment the two of you had together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm glad it was her I got to paddle with.
So, after the trials, like you said, you had made it in the singles and the doubles. Can you tell me a little bit about if you guys had any concerns? I know... Some of the other athletes we had talked to, they were worried about the altitude of Mexico City.
Oh, well, when we lived in Oklahoma City, my sister ran a lot of track. She liked to run, and she was a good runner. And we knew of a fellow named Jack Daniels, who you've probably heard of. I don't know if you've heard of him. Anyway, he's very prominent in track circles.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I think he was going to school in Oklahoma City. But anyway, we met him, and he was studying high altitude training, and he still does that today. He still advises the track team on high altitude training, and he told us to go out to Colorado and train at high altitude, someplace out there on the lake or whatever, and then come down every 2 to 3 weeks to low altitude for a week, then go back up. And that's what we did. My mother had found a lake out there, Beaver Creek Reservoir. It's about 8,500 feet in the southwest part of Colorado. So we stayed out there for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and we drove back to Oklahoma City, where we had a little lake we paddled on for a week. Did that about 3 times. And that's how we trained for high altitude. I don't know how scientific it was, but it helped us a lot.
So you did that in the interim between the trials?
We did that in the summer. Yeah, the summer of 68.
Okay.
See, I think the Olympics in Mexico were also in October.
Yes.
So, you know, we had all summer, not half the summer, but we had all summer to do that.
Do you think that made a difference?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But like I said, our races are a little around 2 minutes or a little bit over. Mm-hmm. So we had one girl in Mexico City in my K-1 final. She's a Hungarian girl. She fell out of her boat, or she actually passed out, I think, out of her boat about halfway down the course because of the altitude training. So, I mean, so she was out of that race. But she redeemed herself and got a medal in the double later on. So I didn't feel sorry for her at that point.
So you'd spent the summer going back and forth from Colorado to Oklahoma City.
Yeah, under Jack Daniels' advice. That's what he told us to do, so we did.
So after that time, let's talk about just going to Mexico City, and you can go ahead and go from there about what your accommodations were like, and so different things just about Mexico City itself that struck you.
Well, we had been down to, they had, in the 3 years before the Olympics, they had, they call them, I think, the Little Olympics in Mexico City. So you could come down and be in competition and see what it was like and what you might have to change or train for the real Olympics. And I was down there in 66 for that little Olympics, and it was on Social Miracle, this filthy canal they had down there. They didn't have the race course built yet. And we just remember, I remember the city being full of diesel fumes because it's in a big volcano, Mexico City is, and they don't have good air circulation down there. But we lived in a village, I think must have been right in the middle of town, and we didn't live out of the race course like we did in Tokyo. So we lived in the main Olympic village, and we ate with the American team in the American dining hall. I think it was with the Canadians and the British and Australians, I think. Can't remember all the teams. Mostly the English-speaking teams. They eat more or less the same kind of food. And so that was a different experience. That was good. Because, you know, it was a different... We got to meet the American team and everything. And, you know, you could sit with the American team or whoever was... Whatever American was there at the table. In whatever sport, you know, they were all there. That's how I met Tom. I don't really remember him from 68, but he said that I sat at his table one time or whatever. I don't really remember a whole lot about Mexico City. I don't know why. I went to 3 Olympics, and I remember the first one and the third one, Munich, the most. But Mexico City, I think, was probably the most fun because it's a very festive place to begin with. And the whole city was decorated up for the Olympics. And we stayed next, in the dorm, we stayed next with the, our next door roommates were the equestrian women who were really nice. They were a little older than we were. But I remember taking the bus out to the race course for workouts, and the whole way out there would be banners flying and everything like that, and it just made it all more festive just to be there.
You mentioned the equestrians. Was there anybody else on the Olympic team that you got particularly close with?
Not really. We were there to paddle, you know, that's what our job was. And not that I, no, apparently not, I don't remember.
As you know, the games were at the height of the Cold War. Did you meet or have any experiences with anyone from the Soviet bloc?
Oh, yeah, the Soviets, the paddlers, they didn't speak English, were real nice. And the same Russian that won my race in Tokyo, she was back again in Mexico City. And they were always real, they didn't live in our same residential block, and we didn't eat the same dining hall, but we saw each other at the race course. But you couldn't really, unless you had a translator, you couldn't really talk to them very well, and they were there for their, they had one job to do, and that was to win gold medals. And I remember after the games, we were invited over to their compound, the Russians, and we went over there, and I was really disappointed to see that Miguel that won my race was smoking a cigarette.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And the reason is because the races were over. She'd done her job. I don't think she smoked all the time. She couldn't have. But that was just a release for them, you know, after the... Cause they had to produce, or... You know, that was the ticket to a better way of life for them back then, was to go to the Olympics and win medals. And that was their job. I mean, we went because we wanted to go. It was the thrill of the Olympics, you know, that brought us there. But the Eastern Bloc did it for their livelihood. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yes, I do.
I mean, that was that, you know, if they didn't produce, then they were off the team. And it wasn't a very good life, I don't think, back there.
Yes.
At that time.
The Mexico City Games, they were also marked by other historical moments. Of course, the first games that were at altitude, which we already discussed.
Right.
But it was also one of the first games that there was a deliberate effort to test the athlete's for performance-enhancing drugs. Pardon me on that. Did you have any personal experiences with that?
Well, they took a piece of our hair to test it for DNA.
Did you speak or talk with any other athletes that were subject to any other type of?
You know, I can't remember whether we had to, at that time, whether we had to, you know, nowadays they make you give a urine sample after your race.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't remember whether we had to do that back then or not. But I do remember they started testing for DNA, see if you make sure you were female.
Right.
It didn't bother me, though. I mean, no problem.
Do you feel like it maybe would have bothered other athletes, or was there a general positive attitude towards those tests?
I don't think it was a big deal.
Okay.
I can't remember. If I don't remember, I guess it wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah, that makes sense. as well, it was one of the more famous moments was Smith and Carlos's Black Power salute.
I wasn't there. I was must have been paddling or something.
Did you feel that you had any specific?
Well, at the time, I was there to paddle. I didn't want to get involved in politics. I didn't understand all that, and so I don't really have a comment back then. The funny thing is, I have a boyfriend, Ron Laird, who you all interviewed Monday, who's a four-time Olympic race walker. So he knew that, and that's track and field. Mm-hmm. He knew John Carlos. And about two, he's here with me now in Michigan for a while, and about 2 weeks ago, John Carlos was invited to come to South Bend to speak at some different places in South Bend, and we went to listen to one of his speeches, and I met him there, and he was really nice guy, and he remembered my friend Ron, the race walker, and so we had a good time talking to him, but I never understood what it was all about until I heard him talk just a couple weeks ago. I know that sounds kind of funny, but
no.
I wasn't into that. I didn't understand it, what was going on back then.
No, that makes sense.
I mean, I was into paddling, and I wasn't into politics. I wasn't involved in that discussion or whatever was going on. I wasn't in track and field. I didn't know the track and field people.
Right.
I didn't know the problem.
Right.
So, I was there to paddle.
Well, since we're on that subject, do you want to give a little commentary about your actual event? There in Mexico City?
Well, I was in two events. Mm-hmm. I was in the singles and the doubles. And I got fourth in the single. And thank goodness I got a bronze the time before. Otherwise, fourth is a very unfortunate spot to be in. But I got fourth in the single. Then I got seventh for my sister in the double, which I was very happy for. You know, I made both finals. And we wish we could have done better, but we did our best, and that's that.
Do you remember having any specific feelings as far as getting to compete with your sister?
I was thrilled to get to compete with her, because she deserved every race she got, and she was so competitive, and she never let you down, and she was always there for you, and so I was proud to be with her in the double.
So you finished the games and you came back home here to the States. Did you have any downtime, or did you go directly back to getting prepared for the next games?
I was 58. I probably had a little bit of downtime, but my husband and I were living here in Buchanan, Michigan at that time. And I think it was the year 1969. We moved to Buchanan, and right next door in Niles is where that fellow lived, Mr. Ray Dodge, that sold us our first boat back in 1960 or 61, that taught us how to paddle. And one of his, back in around 69, his daughter, one of his, he had four girls, a son and four girls. One of his daughters came to me, a young friend, said, Marcia, I'd really like to start paddling. And I said, oh, well, why don't you get some of your high school friends to come out and we can start a club. So we did. We had the Niles Buchanan Kayak Club that started in 69. And so I was still paddling. You know, that really helped me out, having a club there, because it's kind of hard to coach and paddle at the same time. But I did it, and that was a lot of fun. And they, the club, the kids gradually grew up, you know, and about 10 years later, they were all gone from the club. But during that time, I had the club, and then I was training myself. So that worked out pretty well.
As far as the reception of family and friends or community when you got back from the games, was there anything special that you felt people knowing that you had participated as an Olympian?
Because that was my second Olympic. I don't know. Living here, I wasn't a native to this area where I am now, and neither was my husband at the time. And then, so we weren't, I didn't have a lot of friends in this area. That may sound kind of funny, but I didn't. But most of my friends were the paddlers. And I got some newspaper, there was stuff in the newspaper about me going and everything. But then I'd get a request once in a while to give a talk at Rotary or something like that. But that's about all.
Okay. If there is one piece of advice that you would give today's Olympic hopefuls, what would that be?
Is to not let someone say you can't do it. Don't listen to those people.
The other thing that's really important to us in our project is we really want to capture what the preservation of the 1968 U.S. team legacy means to the individuals that were on the team. So if you could just speak a little bit to what does the team's legacy mean to you personally?
Well, I think it's real important to leave something behind for the next future generations to listen to and to see, just for inspiration, that you can do that. What we did, if you set your mind to it, you can make the team, you can be successful. But I mean, I don't know quite what else to say.
Okay. What is your favorite or best experience of your time at the 1968 games?
Well, I tell you, walking into the opening ceremony is something I'll never forget. And I learned in Tokyo, when I was at the Tokyo opening ceremony, I stood where they put me. In the games, they'd say, okay, they'd line you up, and they'd try to put the smallest girls in front, like the gymnasts and stuff, and they worked their way back. Well, I was about 5'6", and I was kind of in the middle, and then I was in the middle of the pack, and I noticed when you walked in that nobody can see you in the middle of the pack. So in Mexico City, I made sure that I stood on the outside. I stood in the proper line I was supposed to be in, but I stood on the outside edge, and I didn't let anybody push me in that was coming late for that line. I just said, no, you can go by me, you can go in the middle. And my sister was right next to me, and we marched in on the right-hand side, which is that you march around, you know, counterclockwise. And then you could see the crowd, and they could see you, and you could hear all the music playing and everything. It was just a big thrill to march in and know that you were a member of one of the greatest Olympic teams of all time, you know, the U.S. team. That's one of my favorite moments was walking in the opening ceremony. In all three of my games that I was in, that was something I really wanted to do. Besides doing well in my race, I wanted to walk in the opening ceremony.
let's just talk briefly about your, I guess, participation, or if you stayed involved with the sport much after the 72 games, or now even in your life.
Well, I stayed, I trained for 72 and went to the moon age in 72, and I got a ninth in the singles. My sister went as an alternate, and so she didn't get to paddle in that game, but she was an alternate. And when I came back from Munich, then I kind of settled down, and I had a daughter that was born in 74 and a son born in 77. But I was still paddling, not training for the Olympics, but I was still paddling. And I had the club, my Niles Buchanan Kayak Club, that I was training. And one of my paddlers I had several paddlers make the next successive teams. So I was working with them. And my husband at the time was, he had been a rower turned kayaker, and he started a business of laying out rowing courses all over the country. You had to have this cable and buoys and stuff in the water. And so he was going around the country doing that in the summertime. And I love to paddle anyway. I paddle this day. I'm waiting for it to get a little bit warmer, and I'll go out, because we live on the river here in Buchanan. And I will start paddling, and I'll paddle all summer several times a week. And both my kids paddled, and with aspirations of making an Olympic team. And my son made the team in 2004. To Athens, my son Jeff. Anyway, that's that. I've stayed involved. I still am interested in paddling. Paddling now is we're having some problems with getting people interested. It's a lot of hard work. Just like any sport is, it's a lot of hard work.
Yes. Well, that's it for my pseudo list of questions, but I just want to give you this time to tell me anything else you think that's important about the 68 games or any of the games that you participated in, or any just anecdotal stories that maybe you would want to be included with this interview about your time at the games, specifically with Sperry, your sister, or anything else that you think might be important.
Well, the Olympics except for the birth of my kids, the Olympics were the highlight of my, have been the highlight of my life, and that's, I'm so glad I trained hard and that I followed through on what I wanted to do. And, like I said, walking in the opening ceremonies was three times was the thrill of a lifetime for me. And then getting a bronze medal in Tokyo was, more than I'd ever bargained for. And I just, I think the Olympics is just well worth it to try and make.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop my recorder.